Hello and welcome to Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Happy Friday to all of you. A special happy Friday to Undivided subscribers who help us to build this mission, grow this mission. If you'd like to become a subscriber for as little as $5 a month, you can do that at patreon.com/undivided or by becoming a contributor on my locals community, brandicruz.locals.com. A few things coming up today. On Fridays with Friends, my friend Ansel Hurst is going to join us to talk about the idea of citizen assemblies. He's working for an organization called Democracy Next, and it has this very wild idea to directly allow citizens to come together, chosen at random, and to be part of actual decision-making and policy-making on controversial issues. It's something that's done elsewhere in the world, not in the United States, but we're going to talk about the concept and whether it would work. Also, he's worked for some interesting political campaigns and politicians, and so we're going to just kind of reflect on some of his time with, for instance, Bernie Sanders during his presidential bid. Also on Florida Report, the state of Florida has backed away from a controversial idea to require student athletes to share information about their menstruation. That all has to do around trans athletes in schools, etc. Miranda will have an update for that on that for us. Plus, Governor Jay Inslee has put these really cumbersome requirements down for state employees that include watching a two-hour documentary on racism in America. I'll have the latest on what he's doing to try to make Washington an anti-racist state. But first, I got to talk about a meeting that happened last night. You know, we've been discussing being your own best watchdog, standing up for yourself when the media won't, when politicians won't. And this has been happening more and more frequently, as citizens feel like they're just kept out of the loop on things that impact their families, their kids, their communities. And in now two communities in Washington State, Tenino and Enumclaw, there has been this pushback over these less restrictive facilities for sex offenders. So I think we talked about the Tenino one where these sex offenders from McNeil Island, which is where sex offenders are housed, are going to be moved into this house, like up to five of them. And it's not as secure as McNeil Island. And so you have residents who are like, first of all, why weren't we asked about this? And we have some really serious concerns about whether these sex offenders can actually be kept securely at this facility. And there was a meeting over the same issue in Enumclaw last night. And that shit got wild. I didn't see it initially, but I was talking to a state lawmaker about some bills they're proposing to deal with all of this, and he mentioned it, and I was like, oh my God, I got to go watch this. So there's this one moment of the meeting in particular. There's a woman who, and this is really crucial to understanding how egregious this is, she is a victim's advocate. It's her job to support victims of sexual abuse and sexual violence. She gets up at what was an already heated meeting, and she addresses, in particular, the concern about these sex offenders being placed in close proximity to a school bus stop. Here is what she had to say.
Now, I want to address the school bus stop. I don't have a dog in this fight. I want the victim's voice to always be heard in whatever scenario I find myself. And Chris Knutson was kind enough. We have done this before in the past. Now, the school bus stops, the windows, and I'm going to simplify this, and y'all might just say, the onus of keeping your kids safe is on you. You need to talk to your kids. You need to open a dialogue with your children. Keep them safe at the bus stop. What can you do? How? Stand up, the two ladies with the bus stop. No, I'm what I'm telling you. What I'm telling you is talk to your kids before they're getting to the bus stop. I can't hear you.
Yeah, so that's a victim's advocate basically saying, hey, if your kids get sexually assaulted, it's on you. Now, is there some validity to the belief that it's up to parents to make sure their kids are safe to the extent they can? Of course, all parents know that. Parents are doing what they can to keep their kids safe. But that doesn't negate their concerns about violent sex offenders living near a school bus stop. There's only so much you can teach your kids. What she did essentially there is victim blaming. And again, as a victim's advocate, she doesn't belong anywhere close to victims. It is such an egregious statement. And if you're just listening on the podcast and not watching the show today, what you won't see is, you know, you hear the parents in the crowd like get more and more animated. And all of a sudden you just start to see their heads pop up because they're just starting to stand up because they're seated in this auditorium. And now they're all just standing up shouting at this woman who just carries on like what she said wasn't absolutely ridiculous, just egregious. And it just goes to show that the concerns of these parents in these communities are so valid. They have every right in the world to be informed when violent sex offenders are going to move into their communities. They have every right to be concerned for the safety of their kids. No, it doesn't fall exclusively on their shoulders to make sure that some child rapist doesn't get a hold of their kid at a bus stop. That statement in and of itself speaks to why it's so important for these parents to be advocating on their own behalf. And I know there are some laws being introduced in Olympia right now, although the clock is ticking as to whether they're going to get support, that would mandate better notification of these families and would also put a pause on transferring sex offenders from McNeil Island until all of this is sorted out in a way that's more transparent. And that's no-brainer stuff. That's really important stuff. Any parent, this isn't political. It shouldn't be political. And I imagine at that meeting there were parents of all different ideologies. Because when it comes down to your kids, politics goes out the window, and common sense has to rear its head. And I'm so proud of these parents in these communities for standing up for themselves, for speaking up for themselves. And I will tell you, if I had a kid and I was in that room, I would have been just as pissed off at being told, "Oh, don't worry about the bus stop. That's your problem. That's not our problem." No, you do share some of that responsibility. So I just had to play that for you guys because I saw that and I was like, oh my God, I hope that lady got an escort to her car because that crowd was absolutely livid. But to those folks in Tenino and Enumclaw, just keep speaking up for yourselves, standing up for yourselves, because what you're doing right now is going to help other communities who would have had one of these facilities shoved down their throats without any sort of input on the matter. And I really hope that at the state level, there can be some policy changes that go about this in a different way. There was a really interesting email sent out by Washington Governor Jay Inslee to all state employees after Tyre Nichols was killed in Memphis. And we talked about the Tyre Nichols case. You had these five black officers, and Tyre Nichols was black, and the officers were part of a specialty unit called the Scorpion Unit. And they beat Tyre Nichols to death for no reason. I mean, I'm firmly convinced that there was no justification for it whatsoever. I mean, I don't know how you could justify what happened to him. But after that happened, Governor Jay Inslee put out an email, and I was sort of holding on to it because I had other things, but there was a secondary issue that popped up this week that made me revisit this email. So the governor sends out an email to all state employees, and the subject line is Tyre Nichols and why our pro-equity, anti-racist work matters. And in the email, the governor is talking about steps they've taken to make Washington an anti-racist state. But, you know, one of the things that really stood out to me is he's talking about racism through the lens of Tyre Nichols, which I just don't understand making that a racial issue when the officers were black and Tyre Nichols was black. The governor wrote in this email, "Late Friday, officials in Memphis released the video footage depicting the brutal murder of Tyre Nichols by five police officers. Such violence is not new, and unfortunately, it remains frequent. Tyre was simply trying to get home. He should be home." I agree with that. He went on to say, "Many of us see stories like Tyre's and feel overcome with anger, sorrow, confusion, fear, and grief. Among the black community in particular, each of these deaths compounds the profound trauma stemming from centuries of anti-black violence." But again, and I'm not arguing with the fact that there's been violence against black people in this country for generations. You can't deny that. But when it comes to Tyre Nichols, the people who beat him to death were black. So anyway, this email just sort of sparked sort of an interest in what, you know, these anti-racist efforts are with the state. And then this week, state employees got an email into their inbox talking about steps the state is going to be taking to basically put some of these initiatives into practice. So state employees got an email and it talks about how they are mandated to do equity training. So I'll just read a little bit of this email. It was sent out from the HR department. In April 2018, Governor Jay Inslee issued a memorandum, it's called Inclusive and Respectful Work Environments, calling on agencies to take action to create inclusive and respectful workplaces. That's fine. I mean, we want to make sure that you go to work and you are accepted regardless of your race or gender or sexual orientation. And that work is a respectful environment, that the workplaces have been doing this kind of stuff for a long time. The email goes on to read, in 2022, the governor issued Executive Order 22-2 called Achieving Equity in Washington State Government. It calls on the State Human Resources Division at the Office of Financial Management to issue a directive requiring all executive cabinet agency employees to complete diversity, equity, and inclusion training that aligns with the Office of Equity's pro-equity anti-racist plan. A lot of words there. A lot of woke words. So anyway, it says that it is working toward developing this training that they're calling a path toward equity, disrupting structural racism through awareness and belonging. And as part of this email, they said they directed employees to read up on what this is going to entail. And then they said the required training includes a prerequisite viewing of the documentary Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America. So before they can even start this diversity, equity, inclusion training, they have to watch a two-hour documentary about racism in America. Now, I went to see if I could try to find this documentary, and you have to buy it. It's like $20, so God knows how much the state paid for the privilege of having its employees watch this documentary. I did find a trailer for it, so I'm going to play that for you now.
We had been on a path toward racial justice that was amazing. There was the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. We were at a tipping point. We're 50 years later now. Once again, America is having to look at issues of race dead in the eye. And once again, we are at a tipping point. And the question for all of us in this room is, what are we going to do about it?
Well, I'm walking and talking with my mind.
If I make the statement to you, America was founded on white supremacy.
I'm walking and talking with my mind.
You could say, Jeff, that's an extreme statement. And what I would say to you is, don't believe a word I say about it. All you have to do is go look.
Slavery had nothing to do with the war because they were treated as family.
I don't know if he can be reached, but if no one tries, he definitely won't change.
Land chance took place in this very spot. Everybody needs to know what happened because it's a part of our history, American history.
America has demonstrated its greatness time and time again, and America is one of the most racist countries on the face of the earth. Those two things are not mutually exclusive. Virginia passed a law, an enslaved person's death while resisting a master is not a felony. Would you look at those words, please, and think about the videos you have seen in the past 10 years?
Shot fired!
It's still not a felony.
Sing hallelujah!
We want all Confederate memorabilia removed from our city.
We have to save other lives.
It's just too big of a story.
Hallelujah!
And this is who we are in America.
A couple things. Just from that trailer, I mean, saying America is one of the most racist countries on earth is just a ridiculous statement. We have, you know, there's like this inability to acknowledge that we've come a long way as a country. Yes, we have a terrible, terrible past, but being able to learn from that, move on from that, move on from this idea that people need to be treated inherently different because of the color of their skin, that's what we tried to move on from. And now we're sort of taking us back to that place in time. Which is terrifying to me, but also, you know, he's talking to people in this documentary that are in the South holding up Confederate flags. Listen, dude, we're in Washington State. We're in one of the most progressive states in the entire country. For the state to force state employees to watch a two-hour video, you know, holding up some extreme examples of people waving Confederate flags in the southern states. It's just stupid. And to use them as examples of how, or as like trying to prove your point that we're still racist. Come on. It's just ridiculous. 2 hours. We learn about slavery throughout our lives. People aren't blind to our country's history. And I feel like this is just another way for them to just say, like, white men are bad. White people are bad. And it's just an uncomfortable sentiment in 2023 in the workplace in a very progressive state with a very progressive workforce. And so the fact that you've got all this time, money, energy being spent on this anti-racist, pro-equity work at the state level, again, is just indicative of government waste. Because I would also argue that if you are someone who is truly racist, and I do believe racist people exist, a 2-hour video training is not going to rid you of that. You're not all of a sudden going to be like, oh, I didn't know about racism and segregation in America. I feel totally different now. No, if you're racist, you're just a bad person. There's no amount of equity training at the state level that is going to fix that. So this is all about making white progressive politicians feel good about themselves. And I think a lot of the equity initiatives, the DEI initiatives, are about that. Making white progressive people feel like, oh, I'm doing my part. No, I mean, racism is very rare in America, in my opinion. We hear examples of it, you know, on the news that are awful. But to suggest America is one of the most racist countries in the world, and to suggest that we need to drive that point home by forcing state employees to watch a 2-hour documentary featuring some crazy people in the South waving Confederate flags is so indicative of what our state chooses to prioritize. Ta-da-da! 10 pounds left to go on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan before I'm back to my pre-COVID weight. And you know what? I was just fine with my pre-COVID weight. Felt good, was and then apparently just sat home and ate my feelings during the pandemic because I was so mad about lockdowns and mandates and everything else that came along with it. But as you know, in November, I started the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan, lost like 25 pounds in 2 months. And I actually got several text messages today from viewers who have started the program. Somebody told me on Facebook that they started 11 days ago and they're down 10 pounds already. I also heard from a friend of mine who said they just started Eastside Weight Loss and it's working, said things have been so stressful. And when I heard you talk about this program on your podcast, I thought, absolutely, yes. And so I'm so glad that some of you have done it and it's working. And like I said, I did a 30-day maintenance period in January, which is required as part of the program. And then if you need to lose more weight, you can start another 60 days. And that's what I'm in right now. So I have a little bit of weight left to go. And then it's about just maintaining it. So for those of you who have heard about it, who've heard me talk about Eastside Weight Loss Clinic, and you're thinking, well, maybe I should try it, just do it. As long as you're confident you can stick to healthier eating. But the nice thing is it's really structured, tells you exactly what to eat, the portion size to eat, and they just help you every step of the way. And you're going to see results fast. If you stick to the program, you can't not see results fast. And so I'm glad I've heard some success stories already from folks who are feeling better in just a really short period of time. So if you'd like to lose your COVID weight like me, or you just want to lose weight that you've been carrying around and you think, why not give it a try? Visit EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. That's EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. You can schedule time for a free consultation with Dr. Coogan, who'll let you know if the program is right for you. Dr. Ryan Coogan, DC, results may vary. Today on Fridays with Friends, I got a chance to chat with a friend of mine, Ansel Herz. We met years ago in Seattle. We were both covering the same issues as journalists at City Hall and policing issues. And it's interesting. He went on to work for a couple of very high-profile politicians who I'm sure you'll know. But now he's working for an organization called Democracy Next. And they're experimenting with this idea that citizen-led efforts to tackle some of our most controversial issues might be the best path to stop this really divisive nature of our political discourse. It would experiment with the idea of something called a citizen assembly, which is done in other parts of the world where you have, much like jury duty, citizens who are brought together to come up with policy recommendations or make policy decisions. So Ansel and I chatted about his time in Seattle, about some of the politicians that he's worked for since then, and also about this new effort with Democracy Next. Ansel, welcome to Undivided.
Hey, Brandy. It's good to be with you.
All the way from Taiwan.
Correct. Yes. We're living here for a year or two. We'll see.
What brings you over there?
It was kind of a family move. My son has been learning Chinese growing up with my wife's family. And so we thought it would be kind of an interesting experience to live here and have him learn the language natively kind of while he's young. And so he's basically within a week of like getting here and starting school, he was like practically fluent in Chinese, which is kind of mind-boggling to witness, even though you kind of expect it. And it's a great place in a lot of different ways. So
that's an awesome experience to have as a kid, but also a really interesting time politically to be living in Taiwan.
Yeah, I mean, I know that most of the kind of American news that we get about Taiwan is about the threat from China, right? And, you know, the prospect of like an invasion. The thing is, when you get here, people have been living with this kind of possible threat for decades now. And it's just kind of, it's a little bit like global warming in that way, if you, you know, consider global warming a threat. And so they're just kind of used to it, right? And it's not something that like everyone's worried about every day. There are fighter jets that do like practice drills overhead where we live. So that's kind of like a daily reminder that it's a thing. But it's just an interesting place. And it's a very, I would say, you know, harmonious society in a lot of ways. And obviously you can go, you know, down different layers of that. And maybe that's kind of just an initial impression. I haven't been here that long, but you know, if you ever get the chance to visit, I do recommend it. It's also the place where bubble tea was invented. So
very cool. Yeah. Awesome experience. I, as a kid, that would have been so cool to live abroad and to learn a different language so young. So that's awesome. It's interesting. So you had reached out to me and sent me a DM on Twitter saying, hey, would love to come on your show and just talk politics. And I think it's fair to say that there's a lot of daylight between our political views. Is that fair?
I would assume so. I mean, but I also think part of the reason I wanted to come on is because I think sometimes the daylight that we perceive is kind of gets magnified over social media, because I mean, I've only ever been in the same room with you, like maybe a few times at some press conferences and things like that. Every time I have been in the room with you, I've in general, you know, thought that you were kind of like a fair and professional and seemingly genuine person, right? And I don't know, hopefully I gave off somewhat of a similar impression. I don't know. I just think that, you know, maybe, you know, if we have the time and the chance to kind of chat more, we might have more common ground than we expect. And that's kind of the direction that I've gone in my career lately. And so I guess we can talk about that as well.
Yeah, I definitely want to build up to your work with Democracy Next, because I'm just learning about that organization. After you messaged me, I was sort of diving into it a little bit. And so I want to talk about that for sure. You mentioned, you know, we met covering press conferences together because you were a reporter for The Stranger, which people of this show will be familiar, because The Stranger writes something about me like every week, how I'm a right wing, you know, whack job or something. But what was your beat at The Stranger when you were there?
I started as an unpaid intern, and my byline when I started was literally unpaid intern, and you didn't see my name until the very bottom of the article. And so, you know, that was like the tongue in cheek kind of nature of The Stranger, kind of poking fun at the fact that like I wasn't even being paid. I worked my way up to being a staff reporter and eventually kind of, took over the police beat in particular. I'm proud of the work that I did there. I think I broke a number of important stories. You mentioned your listeners may not have that positive impression of the newspaper. I don't really know. I think the one thing though that you can appreciate about The Stranger, right, is that at least you know what you're getting.
Yeah.
I never tried to, you know, hide my political beliefs or my political biases, right? We're all subjective human beings. And I actually believe that journalists should be more honest about that, like from all quarters. So, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post kind of hold themselves out as being omniscient or being objective. You know, they're so fair. I don't think that's true. I think they've all got their biases. through, you know, who their sources are, who they, you know, what stories they pursue, what stories they don't pursue. And so it's just better, I think, for journalists in general to try to be fair, for sure, but also just to be honest about, we all have our beliefs and our biases that we bring to the work and not pretend to hide it. And I think maybe you've kind of gone in that direction since leaving corporate TV. And I think that's a good thing. I think readers can appreciate and listeners can appreciate that we're all human beings. We're all going to make mistakes. We all have our own ideas, and we bring those with us everywhere we go. And journalists aren't above that. And I think actually readers and listeners start to get annoyed when journalists pretend that they're, you know, a class above, and they aren't, and we aren't. And so I always actually like that about The Stranger, you know, more than say the Seattle Times, right? Like The Stranger is just, it's a bunch of rambunctious lefties mostly, and trying to kind of report on the city and give their take. And sometimes that's done with original reporting as well. And I think I did a fair amount of that, you know, with public records requests and other sorts of things. So.
Yeah. And it is a fair point. And it's kind of similar to my point that I've made over and over about Shama Sawant. You know, I don't agree with her, but I do know what I'm getting from her. And she's always going to be very consistent. That's very true for The Stranger as well. And yeah, I kind of laugh sometimes at, you know, the blogger types in Seattle who will say, well, you're not a journalist. And I say, well, I know I'm doing commentary. It says it in my bio that I'm engaged in commentary and giving my opinion on politics. From the time that you, because when did you leave The Stranger?
It was a little bit before Trump was elected. So a little bit before 2016.
Okay. You know, that time what we were covering was when it came to policing and stuff was the consent decree and this federal oversight of the Seattle Police Department. When you look at, you know, what you were covering related to policing then and what's going on in the city right now, you know, with the short staffing, some of the crime issues that we're having, you know, some of what happened in 2020. I guess, can you talk about that through the lens of what you experienced covering policing in the city, in City Hall for that matter?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't my beat anymore, right? So yeah. I have to confess I'm a little bit more out of the loop than I guess I used to be. But I would say just kind of from afar, you know, what I was covering in the day-to-day really was the DOJ consent decree process, right? That was what was kind of dominating the headlines when I was a reporter on this subject. And, you know, it was like Ed Murray and Kathleen O'Toole. And there was a point at which Loretta Lynch, the attorney general under Obama, came to Seattle, held this press conference, and declared that basically all these reforms under the DOJ had been an incredible success and that they were just a model for the nation, right? And basically like everything's hunky-dory. Everything is like on track, this is great. And then sure enough, it was, I think it was the next summer or maybe the summer after that, you know, the Black Lives Matter kind of protests broke out and it all that stuff just seemed to kind of go out the window, right? I don't think the idea that like there was trust that had been rebuilt or that, you know, a corner had been turned, I think just kind of got swept away in all of that. And I just think that speaks to actually what I always felt as a reporter, which was that the reforms were quite hollow and didn't really change the fundamental kind of culture issues that I think perhaps still exist at SPD. And, you know, I'm not somebody who really thinks that that's an issue with individual officers so much as it's more of a system problem. And I think that the changes that are required probably need to go further and need to be deeper than they ever were.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, I get called a bootlicker a lot, but I just tend to give, I guess, law enforcement the benefit of the doubt because I know their jobs are very difficult, but it doesn't mean that I want them to have, you know, free pass and a free rein to do whatever they please. I think we saw in Memphis what happens when law enforcement gets free pass and free rein to do whatever they please. But, you know, you mentioned the word hollow with the reforms. I think from my perspective, I saw a lot of the protests as being a little bit hollow. Like, I love a good First Amendment, but in 2020, you know, when we saw people using George Floyd's death to loot businesses downtown or, you know, the autonomous zone on Capitol Hill, I just saw politicians giving into really unreasonable behavior and vilifying the police over unreasonable behavior. And so it's interesting to kind of, you know, think about my perspective of that and someone else's perspective of that being more of an issue with the police than of the behavior of rioters on the street.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for any of the protesters or any of the politicians. I mean, you mentioned Thomas Sowant earlier, and I think it's really interesting that he actually was one of the, he was the only council member to vote against ratifying the contract with FOG, the police union, the big police union in Seattle, about a year before Chaz and CHOP and all this stuff, right? He's the only one to vote against it. All the other ones voted for it. And then when the protests happened, all those other council members flipped. And so I think that politicians respond to protest. And I don't know, your take on the rioters may be different than mine. I think many of the protesters were peaceful, right? And so I'm never one to sort of get into like trying to conflate or assign blame. I just think that, you know, that consistency point is interesting. And it's part of why I've ended up working for Democracy Next.
Yeah, you always have the good actors and the bad actors, the people who have good intentions and bad intentions. I think that's true with police. I think it's true certainly with folks who were in the streets in the summer of 2020. You went on from The Stranger, and your first job out of that was to work for Congresswoman Jayapal. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Are you surprised by just how quickly her star has risen?
No, not really. I mean, I think she always kind of intended and hoped to use her congressional seat to try to kind of spur nationwide change, you know, to not just be an advocate for Seattle and for her constituents, but really to kind of like use that platform in a very effective way. And I think she's done that, whether you agree or disagree with the things that she's fighting for.
And your role with the Congresswoman was it press secretary?
I was her deputy communications director.
And what was it like to work for her?
She was great and I think is great, very demanding and very hardworking. And, I think that's probably what you want in a politician sometimes more than, or in a member of Congress. I'm proud of having worked for her. And I think that she, you know, she's gone on to be the leader of the Progressive Caucus. She's definitely playing an integral role in sort of some of the policies that are being developed now at the national level. So I think she's overall doing a great job. Certain listeners might disagree with that. But I think the one thing, again, that like you can't really take away from her is that she's not taking corporate money. She doesn't take PAC money. She's unencumbered in that sense, and I think fighting genuinely for her beliefs.
There was some negative headlines about the Congresswoman. People in her staff were coming out saying she was horrible to work for, very, very demanding. You mentioned earlier, you know, she is very ambitious. She is very hardworking. Do you think that those criticisms were fair, or was it sort of that you've got this ambitious, hardworking woman and it was sort of taken the wrong way?
I would say more on the latter side for sure. I think that, I think she worked harder than anyone else in the office. So I don't know what else to say. And I think she, you know, just expects her staff to work hard as well. And I never saw anything untoward. And so, I mean, if some people had issues with it, I don't know really what to say.
Do you think Gen Z is just not used to high expectations in the workplace?
No, I wouldn't put it that way, but I think there's other offices where that's an issue. You know, in general, congressional offices, actually there's a congressional workers union now that has, I think, just launched this last year. And one of the interesting things is that for a long time, congressional staff have not had any sort of union protection. And so, you know, you can get kind of fired at the drop of a hat. So I think on a structural level, you know, there should probably be more protections for staff who are in these very like demanding, high, you know, intensive jobs that require a lot of hours and require you to be extremely responsive. And so Yeah, I just think that that's a really good effort. You know, if you really care about staff and congressional offices, go support that union.
Yeah. Quickly, I do want to ask you about Bernie Sanders. I actually think that you got me an interview with Bernie Sanders. Was that your doing?
Could have been.
Yeah, maybe. Well, because you worked for him when?
I was working for him during his second run for the presidency.
Yeah, he came to Tacoma, and I want to say that you had given a few names of reporters to sit down with them. We had a very lively 5-minute interview. There was a lot of pointing. Yeah, we had an interesting interview. I got an immediate first impression of him that was not positive. It was just the way he was speaking to his staff, the way he spoke to me, but he's kind of this gruff guy, I guess. You know, he's an old curmudgeon. What was your experience working for him in a presidential campaign?
I was actually, I'll just say it was fantastic. It was, yeah, I mean, I had a lot of fun, and I thought that it was great. So, and Bernie was a great boss as well. So, you know, I would say as well, like, pretty demanding and, you know, very hardworking. People who are close to him will tell you that, you know, they're incredibly surprised that somebody of like that age has as much energy as he has. He always just wanted kind of ideas from his staff, and you know, whatever kind of struck him as a good idea, he wanted to go for. And he also really saw social media as kind of one of his connections to people, and he really cared about communicating effectively through social media to try to, you know, have that kind of line to the American people, kind of in the way that I think like FDR did the fireside chat, you know, back in the day. So it was really fun. It was a good experience.
Yeah, it just shows you. I mean, first impressions are one thing. And he is just, is it fair to say he can be a little bit of a curmudgeon?
Oh, for sure. I mean, he went to the New York Times editorial board, and I think in their endorsement interview with them, he said, I don't do birthdays. Like, I just don't. People want me to call and wish them a happy birthday. I don't do it. You know, so it's like, I don't know. You got to love that authenticity, right?
He is who he is. On that kind of, you know, that was an interesting election because, again, you had that kind of, you know, I'm reminded of him and Elizabeth Warren on stage during a presidential debate. And she said he called him a liar. And there was sort of some, you know, real tension between the two of them. Did that kind of play out behind the scenes? I mean, was there as much tension behind the scenes amongst the Democratic candidates as the media was suggesting there was publicly?
Well, I wasn't some super high ranking guy or anything, so I don't really know the ins and outs of it. But I guess I will say that, and maybe this can be start of a transition to talk about democracy next. I mean, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders probably agree on like 90% of things or more, I don't know, right? They're both kind of the progressive left. And, you know, the way that the primary system and the election pitted those two camps against each other was really toxic in a way. And I think that's kind of what we see writ large, you know, not just on the Democratic side, but I know that, you know, there's internecine fights on the Republican side as well, right? Marjorie Taylor Greene is standing with Kevin McCarthy, Matt Gaetz, and, you know, who's acting in good faith, who isn't. And, you know, one minute they're allies, one minute they're not. And so that's kind of the high stakes game that the system forces us into. And I'm kind of interested in trying to figure out some ways out of that. Because yeah, I mean, I knew people who worked for Elizabeth Warren, really great people, but at that kind of push and shove moment where you know, ultimately somebody's going to be the winner, it does create that kind of like toxic feeling. And it's not good. It's just, I think that's why people are kind of disgusted with politics, to be honest, because it just comes down to this like fight for power. And sometimes you, it can be very demoralizing. And I don't think it feels good as a human being sometimes.
Yeah, and that's a great segue into Democracy Next, because this is where you and I, whatever political disagreements we have, are in total agreement on. I just don't think the system is working for people. I think it has become incredibly toxic. And it's one of the reasons I just refuse to identify with either political party. So what is Democracy Next?
Democracy Next is a nonprofit that is based in Paris. And I just joined as a communications director this past year. It was just founded by two former analysts and researchers from the OECD, which is kind of an adjacent body to the United Nations. And they have been doing all this research on deliberative democracy and citizens' assemblies. And I know those are probably new words that people haven't heard so much. But what those are basically, they're almost like juries. So a citizens' assembly is where a group of people are randomly selected from the public. If you're just sort of a citizen who, is in the census, you can be randomly selected. And then if you want to do it, you're brought into a room. You're basically asked to examine an issue and come up with some policy recommendations on, what should we do about this? And so this has been done all over the world. It's been done in Ireland. It's been done in Mongolia, South Korea, Belgium, all over the place. And it kind of harkens back to what democracy really is. So if you look at the root of the word, right, it comes from ancient Greece and it means rule by people. And so not to be a total nerd on this stuff, but in ancient Athens, this is what democracy meant. It meant randomly selecting from among the public and having everybody come together into an assembly and make decisions together. And the Greeks were actually kind of against elections because elections necessarily concentrate power in such few hands. And they also self-select for these really kind of charismatic, sometimes manipulative people. I think if you spend time around political candidates, you kind of start to see that trend. And so I'm really interested in a citizens assembly, whether it's in Seattle or anywhere else, because I think it has the ability, and this has been shown through data and research, to overcome a lot of the polarization that we see, the toxicity that we see, and really kind of give power back to ordinary people. Where this has happened, when people come into the room together, it's not like they start yelling at each other and declaring, I'm a Republican, you're a Democrat, you suck. Actually, what happens is once you're face to face, just like in a jury, this happens in American juries, every day, right? Our jury system still seems to work and hasn't been destroyed by this polarization. Once you're in the room together, and you kind of know that you have this duty as a community and with the people around you to figure this issue out, it usually works. And often the research has shown, and this has been done in America as well, that the viewpoints sort of start to converge, right? And people start to sort of think about things in ways that they hadn't before. And you get out of the bubble that perhaps you're in. If you're a listener of this program, or, perhaps I've been in the bubble a little bit over the past decade. So that's really what it is. And that's what the organization is about.
It's really interesting in concept. I have a lot of questions about it in practice. How would that fit into our current system? Because it sounds like if you're going to do that, it's a complete overhaul of what we're doing now. And so you mentioned Seattle. Is it something that would be better started at the local level as opposed to trying to change, a system that's been in place in the United States for so long?
I mean, probably. I think most change starts a little bit small, right, or starts local. So I think, if Seattle is interested in these ideas, maybe with all the turnover in the city council, there's kind of an opening for this. I think that's great. So I don't know that this sort of system can be, implemented at the national level overnight. I think what Democracy Next is about and what I'm sort of trying to do is just kind of get the idea out there a little bit more. And if a community wants to try it and do it, I think there's quite a bit of evidence to show that it's worth doing. In Ireland, for example, they had these long running controversies over abortion and gay marriage. And, famously sort of Catholic country. And, again, people were kind of in these camps. And then they decided to empower a citizens assembly to look at this, look at both issues. Citizens assembly of about 100 Irish people looked at it for a number of months. They brought in different people, you know, healthcare providers, religious leaders, bishops, all kinds of folks. Ultimately, they decided that they felt like this sort of like outright ban on abortion should be scaled back. And then their recommendation that they came to, it was a majority of the assembly participants, that recommendation was then put to referendum, right? It was put to the whole population of Ireland, and the whole population ratified it. And that was sort of the start of what the Secretary General to the Irish President, who's on Democracy Next board, that was the start of what he says is kind of the transformation of Irish politics. And they now use these citizens' assemblies on all kinds of issues to sort of give citizens the chance to actually get involved directly and then kind of look at the issue, you know, fairly dispassionately. And you can actually go watch the videos of some of these sessions online, and you see people really getting invested in it, you know, and in a really kind of constructive way. So I'm sure you've got a million practical questions, and it kind of sounds, you know, I think we've become really cynical, but I think, again, like the experience of these assemblies being run in so many different places has shown us that it actually does work.
Yeah, it sounds more feasible to me when it is those individual issue level things. Like, it's not, this is replacing the current system of government, but it's, hey, we've got this issue that's really hard to figure out where to land on. Let's get a bunch of citizens in the room to brainstorm. I hate like panels and stuff, but the thing I hate about panels, like they're considering one in Washington State, a 19-person panel to study police pursuits, is that it's people appointed by politicians. And to me, I'm right. Like, well, the politicians should just do it then if they're going to pick the people to put on this panel. So you're saying that this would be like,
I'm with you on that.
Amongst registered voters?
Yeah, I think in most places, this has been done, I believe, with census data. But I mean, to be honest, I'm not really a full-on expert on this stuff yet. The person who is an expert is actually one of the founders of Democracy Next! Her name is Claudia Schwalli, and she has like both done a lot of research and also helped design some of these assemblies that are actually active in different places. And she's coming to Seattle on March 3rd, so I'll just mention that now. And so, you know, in terms of kind of the logistics of how it's done, how is the random selection done, you know, she can answer questions on all of that, I think, quite effectively.
And if people want to go to that, can you give the info again?
Yeah, so the talk is going to be at Town Hall on March 3rd at 7:30 p.m. And I think we're hoping to have you perhaps join us, because we're again trying to, you know, again, for me, one of the big things about this is that it has been shown to reduce polarization. It has been shown to, it's a way to overcome this kind of idea that I'm on a different side from you, Brandy, or that, you know, all of your listeners are only conservative and they can't talk to other people, or you know, all the people in Seattle are the enemy because they think a certain way. Like, it's really an attempt to start to get out of that. And so, that is the hope, is that, you know, both you and maybe somebody from who's seen as sort of being from more the liberal or the left side can join us in the conversation.
Yeah, and I'll certainly, if it's something I'm able to make happen, I told you I need to check my schedule for that day, but I'll definitely let folks know and repost the time and the place and all that. So Ansel, this has been really interesting. It's nice to catch up. I know it's like, as we tape this, like midnight where you are, so we'll let you go to sleep, but thanks for being here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Brandy.
It's Friday. That means it's time to check in with my sister, Miranda. It is our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Hello, sister dearest.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Sorry we canceled on you last week, but I, as you know, I got locked out of the studio, but it turned out fine because it was your birthday. How was your birthday?
My birthday was great. Thank you. I didn't do too much. I kind of took the day off, took a nap, which was fantastic. And then I really wanted to just go get like hot dogs. So I made my boyfriend find a good hot dog restaurant. We went and ate hot dogs. So it was a nice birthday.
Yeah, 36?
36.
Oh man, we're getting up there, aren't we?
I know I'm closer to 40 now, and it really stresses me out a little bit. But then it's also like, nah, like it's fine. I can handle aging.
It's all good. It was really fun to have you here for a week. We went wedding dress shopping, went to Leavenworth, did all sorts of fun stuff.
Yeah, I actually always really enjoy my trips out there, not just because I get family time, but because I do really enjoy just being up in the Pacific Northwest. You guys have just such beautiful landscapes.
Yeah. So does Florida. So let's dive into it. There was this story that was highly controversial that there has been an update to. We didn't talk about it because I think we would have ended up talking about it last week. But so Florida schools were going to ask student athletes about their menstrual cycles, their periods. Yes. And the thought process behind that was?
I am assuming the thought process behind that is simply just to kind of have another angle of attack, for lack of a better word, against transgender youth, in my opinion. I'm not sure what they were planning on doing with the menstrual cycles, but to me, it just seems like a way of like maybe calling out a transgender youth who can't answer those questions and maybe identifies as a female. I really don't know, but they're not doing it anymore. So,
well, before we get to the update, it's because Florida doesn't want biological males competing with women. And I agree with that sentiment because they're just not the same. And I don't think that's fair to young girls who are trying to be competitive. I absolutely don't agree with going about it that way, making biological women talk to their school about their menstrual cycle. That's just weird. So as you said, there's an update here. They're not doing it anymore.
Yeah, they had an emergency meeting this past week, and they removed all questions of a child's menstruation from these forms, which they should. I mean, the only people that should be asking about that are your doctors or your parents, and that's about it. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I kind of agree with you. I also think this is one of those things that's like, they should just let like kids decide. Like kids should be able to vote whether or not they want that within their peer groups, not parents. I mean, that's my attempt at trying to like allow the youth a little bit of a responsibility towards their new generation that maybe we don't understand fully. Cause like, what if the kids are like, I don't care if they have transgendered males and females, you know, playing sports. We haven't really asked them as far as I know. So I don't know how I feel about it, but I definitely am not cool with them having such personal questions on school forms.
Well, and it also, you know, I think when we get lost in these culture wars, we also forget our values. And, you know, for Republicans in Florida who are in charge, it is very much not a limited government value to be probing like that into a child's life at school. And so I think, you know, you can get so caught up in the culture wars and some of these issues that you lose sight of what you say you're all about. So I'm glad they backed away from this. That's just a different level of absurdity. There are ways to go about it without asking about menstruation.
Very true. Right. I'm an adult female and I don't even like talking about it. So I can't imagine being a girl faced with those questions.
Exactly. You did a little sleuthing this week. So we've been talking a lot about homelessness in Washington State. And you've said, and I've noticed when I've gone down there, yeah, I see the occasional homeless person, but you do not see the encampments there that we see here. But you did see one. It was the first one you'd ever seen down there. And you did a little digging into what it was.
Yeah, so I was driving down the highway on my way home, kind of close to the airport, and I just, you know, was stuck in a little traffic, so I was just looking around, and I saw kind of out of the corner of my eye down off the highway an encampment of obviously of homeless nature, and I was like, oh, wow, so that's where the homeless people are. So I just kind of quickly Googled, you know, SR-112, which was the state road I was on, and homeless encampment, and it comes to find out that these people that live in this homeless encampment are actually sexual predators. They're sex offenders. And they're convicted sex offenders, of course. And I found out that Miami-Dade County has really strict restrictions on where sex offenders can actually live. And it's so strict that they can't really live anywhere in Miami. So they've kind of been forced into homelessness because they can't be within 2,500 feet of bus stops, schools, even homeless shelters, they can't even be close to. So they literally had to create their own community somewhere else. And I found it.
And you found it, unfortunately. I mean, I don't think it's fair to say they were forced into homelessness. I mean, they're the ones who are sexual predators, and also they could move outside of Miami-Dade County to an area where the restrictions aren't so high. I mean, there are places in Florida where they can live, but for whatever reason, they've chosen to instead have this little homeless encampment in Miami-Dade County. But it does concern me. I would rather them loosen the restrictions a little bit so that they're living somewhere where you can better keep track of them. You can't keep track of sexual predators who are living in tents.
Yeah, and I thought that too. I'm like, that's a little bit of a loose way to have them where they live, because who knows where they roam, you know what I mean? But like, I also did a little bit more like back research and realized that when I first moved to Miami, we have a land bridge. We have two land bridges that connect the city of Miami to the city of Miami Beach. For those that don't know, Miami Beach is actually its own entity. It's an island separated from the city. On one of the land bridges is where they were originally camped out at. And that was between like the years of like 2006 to 2010 before they finally cleared out the encampment, because it's like, you know, you have all these tourists driving to the beach and there's tents all along the highway. So this is apparently where they moved them after they kicked them off of Julia Tuttle. They moved them over by the airport. And they've tried to, ever since 2019, I've been finding articles about them trying to move them again. They kind of go through and clean up the space from time to time, but like, there still is no other place for them to go. And like you said, like, if they could loosen the restrictions a little bit so that they could find homes, they could be easier to track. Well, the state of Florida, their law is 1,000 feet from those locations. But we had a lobbyist in the early 2000s that had a daughter that was sexually abused by somebody. And so he became really passionate about this. And he created this new restriction of 2,500 feet, which really puts them in a position that there is absolutely nowhere to live in a city so densely populated as Miami.
Yeah, and it's challenging. You know, we're having our own debate here about the housing of some sex offenders on the outskirts of a relatively small community near the capital city of Olympia. And it is this kind of push and pull between, okay, if somebody's been convicted, they've served their time, we need to make sure that they have some capacity to be able to live a more productive life moving forward. But when you're talking about people who are sexually violent predators, that's a behavior that isn't going to change. And so I understand having a lot of restrictions for them, but is it so much so that you make it impossible for them to improve their lives? And that's what it sounds like is happening down there, which I don't particularly agree with either. Interesting stuff. Miranda, out doing the deep dives into homelessness, what little exists of it in Miami.
You know, I do what I can. I'm assuming they all come up to you guys, because like, I really don't see very many homeless people. I know they're here and I do see them like sleeping on the sidewalk from time to time, but they're never allowed to stick around for too long where they can set up a whole home with like a garage and stuff like I see in some of your encampments. They live like some pretty interesting lives out there in Seattle as homeless or what do you guys call them out there? Not homeless.
Unhoused people experiencing homelessness.
Yeah. And sometimes I feel bad saying homeless because it does seem like a little bit of a mean way to explain people. But yeah, unhoused persons.
Yeah. I mean, when you can be so comfortable being homeless in a place that you build a 3-story structure in a park, there is a problem. And that has happened here.
That's a little rough. They should go build Airbnbs in the woods and like make some money or something if they're that good at architecture.
Little tiny house. All right, Miranda, good stuff. Happy belated birthday.
Thank you. It's good to see you guys again.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
All right, we went a little long today, but happy Friday to all of you. Have an absolutely wonderful weekend. I've got some relaxing plans of my own. But keep in mind, you know, we've been making some calls to action on certain bills, like the pursuit bill. I just talked on the Wednesday show about Senate Bill 5599, which like gives shelters cover to kidnap your kids if they're there for, you know, some sort of protected health care. It's just odd. Next Friday, so a week from today, is the cutoff for bills to make it to the next stage. in the process in Olympia. So really, there's only a few days left if you haven't made your voice heard on some of these bills to do that. So I'll keep that in mind, and maybe that's a good task for you this weekend. Thanks for joining us on Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz, and a special thank you to subscribers. If you don't subscribe already, it's just $5 a month to support this podcast and the work we're doing. You can do that at patreon.com/undivided or by becoming a contributor on my locals community, brandicruz.locals.com.